Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a panel discussion titled Contemporary Issues of Black Masculinity in the Media. Our discussion is presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. We begin with an introduction of our panelists by African American Studies Program Director Linda Hayward.
First, I'd like to introduce Professor C.P. Koss, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Cultural Foundations at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. His topic is Integration Matters, Black Male Images as Tools of Consumption or Liberation. Dr. Koss is an associate professor in the Department of Teacher Education and Higher Education at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Our next panelist is Dr. Natalie Hopkinson, author of Deconstructing Tyrone. Her topic will be Deconstructing Tyrone, A New Look at Black Masculinity. Dr. Hopkinson is a media and culture critic for The Root, a web magazine edited by Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and launched by Slate Magazine and the Washington Post Company. Next on the program is our own Dr. Deborah Jaramillo, Assistant Professor of Film and Television, Boston University. Her topic, the presence or relative absence of African-American men on television. Next, we have Patrick Sylvain, a visiting lecturer in Latin American Studies, Brown University. His topic focuses on commodification of blackness through regenerative negative symbolization. Mr. Sylvain is an academic, poet, writer, photographer, and a social critic. Our next panelist is our own Dane Peters. He's a student in the African American Studies here at Boston University, pursuing his MA degree. He's currently researching transnationalism and the role of West Indian radicals. And our last panelist is no less than Dexter L. McCoy. He's a Umoja member, a BFA student and of the College of Fine Arts, Boston University. I'd like you to welcome all our panelists.
My topic, Integration Matters, Black Male Images as Tools of Consumption or Liberation. It's focused in the context of some work that I did while I was doing my PhD work in Cincinnati. And so I'm going to open my presentation with two pieces, one from the book and one from my latest book, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusive Education. Brother Denied, taken from chapter 3. We no longer hold you up above the heavens in which the gods drink their nectar. We no longer pay you homage for the ancestry and kinship that is rightfully yours. Our eyes no longer look at you with love and compassion that often greets those of royalty. The smell of dirt and shiftlessness tickle our noses because of the disdain for whom and what you represent. Our waiting has been in vain for your rise to the position of lover, authority, and head of household. The births that we welcome, you have ceased to occur. Why? You kill that which is born from you. By neglecting the spirits which spoke of your glory and of your coming, we hide from you. You who they hate, but we embrace. You who we long love. To end your terror, our love is your love. Yet you will not receive. Freedom from self is what you need. Why? We know not. Yet, you are the one, the denied brother, brother denied. I wrote that in the middle of writing that text and realized that it was something about looking at myself through the images that are portrayed on television, that are reproduced and repackaged through the mediated public sphere that we have in popular culture. So thinking about that, I moved into another realm. Berger often says, publicity turns consumption into a substitute for democracy. The choice of what one eats or wears or drives takes the place of significant political choice. Publicity helps to mask and compensate for all that is undemocratic within society. And it also masks what is happening in the rest of the world. So it's through this publicity that our pain is masked. So what is black masculinity? But through my years of research, I decided to define it. Much of the literature, the definition was quite fluid. So through my own understanding, black masculinity, a social construction of physical, cultural, political, emotional, and performative behaviors of biologically sexed males whose lineages are connected to the continent of Africa, with an appropriation of slavery as the historical context. It is also a construct of raced, sexualized representations of black male performance within popular culture. So as I was journeying through my presentation of looking at black masculinity 10 years ago at Miami of Ohio, my research took me to Over the Rhine. And so some of you do not know what Over the Rhine is. It's a community that has a 98% poverty rate and a 95% criminal rate. And I decided one day on the bus, seeing a brother who had on his Tims, who had his rag on, and I decided to get off the bus and follow this young man to ask him a question. I followed him down in the Over the Rhine, and I said, why do all of you brothers usually hang out between 10:30 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Why aren't you in school? What's going on in your life? Maybe you can help me understand why you like hanging out on the corner. He said, well, first of all, we get pushed out of school. I used to like school, but when I was in middle school, there were teachers who told me I wasn't going to be anything. He said, but I want you to meet somebody else. And I talk about Raheem and the leaders of the new school. That group adopted me, and I spent a year and a half studying them, and they told me everything I wanted to know about black masculinity, rap, hip-hop, culture, family, and their understanding how they could utilize the images as tools of consumption. By the time I got through with them, we talked about these images as tools of liberation. And that began my whole 15-year quest of understanding that. And the thing that is most powerful, whenever we renegotiate our identities, because all of us come from many different identities, be that sexualized, be that economic, all of them are performances, based on my research and coming from a social science background. We perform who we are. Race and performance is being reappropriated. One of the biggest disappointments I face as an educator is having my soul and spirit ripped out of my work. As an educator, I am faced with continually encouraging students, educators, and parents in the midst of harsh realities, funding shortages, accountability, testing challenges, in addition to tightening legislative policies, which squeeze the life out of our optimism on a daily basis. Our lives today are filled with the availability of global news 24 hours a day. The media is filled with situations and circumstances which are detrimental to the human condition, such as war, famine, disease, and greed. Do we want to continue on this self-destructive path? Education was once presented as the great equalizer. However, the ability to make large sums of money and an alarming rate, and at the expense of others, seems to dominate our reality TV shows. Every basketball player now want to be a rapper. But they're not making enough shooting hoops? What's going on? It's become more and more about the Benjamins and less about education. The world of entertainment in its many facets has grown into a multi-trillion dollar business while education has taken the back seat. Many citizens in the United States are striving to build new football, basketball, and baseball stadiums instead of building new infrastructure and school facilities. This perspective has communicated and created a generation of students who believe the desires of the individual are more important than group success. Students are becoming substance abusers at alarming rates. Recreational drugs are more prevalent in high schools today than textbooks. The war on drugs has been replaced with the war on terrorism, which is indeed a political act because America was losing the war on drugs anyway. Here's my carrot. The representation of black masculinity by popular culture continues to give young black men a false construction of who they are. And I queer the definition as I go on. I get into this notion of what is biologically male, physically male, socially male. By drawing deeply on deep felt moral panics about crime, violence, gangs, and drugs, numerous black entertainers, namely athletes and rap artists, have rewritten the historic tropes of black masculinity from provider and protector to pusher and pimp. So I say to you today, I leave you with a question. That masculinity, particularly black masculinity, is a performative piece that has to be deconstructed and situated within a historical, cultural, and social political dynamic. It's not just a saying, as water is water, H and 2 and O. Black masculinity is a fluid dynamic and a didactic that has to be reconstructed and deconstructed so that we can begin the conversations for understanding how to help the black brother. Thank you very much.
My name again is Natalie Hopkinson, and I am the co-author of Deconstructing Tyrone, A New Look at Black Masculinity in the Hip-Hop Generation. And I'm really thrilled to be out here talking about Tyrone again. We actually published this book in 2006, in the fall of 2006, which was a couple years early for the real profound seismic shift in the way that black masculinity is mediated because of course, our president. And, you know, every time I see him, to understand that this is the face of global power right now. So for children who are growing up, and my children included, the whole study is completely skewed. You know, if you were to do a study of black masculinity in the media right now, it would be dominated by news from the White House and news from the State Department or wherever else he's traveling all around the world. But it's still interesting to look back on our project because, you know, as Dr. Gauz was saying, we do need to deconstruct these images. My partner and I, Natalie Y. Moore is my partner. She's another journalist based in Chicago who co-wrote this book with me. As members of the media, we were both newspaper writers at the time we decided to do this book. We were very frustrated with being part of the media machine that's churning out these images. We really wanted to find an opportunity and a forum to be able to critique them and to be able to think more deeply about why they exist, why these stereotypes come about. The image of black masculinity that we saw in the media resembled nothing of the lives that we knew. Doing this book was a way for us to deconstruct those images. I'll talk very briefly about Kwame Kilpatrick, and then I'll read a little bit from my chapter on Etan Thomas. Kwame Kilpatrick was the mayor of Detroit when my partner Natalie Moore was covering City Hall. So it was a very interesting way to look at Kwame because they were peers, essentially. Natalie was 30-something, you know, they're both hip-hop generation, and so they sort of had this very playful relationship, Natalie and Kwame did. But she also was horrified at his failings, moral and otherwise. And, you know, this, of course, was published before he went to jail and before the story was really over, so really understanding that he was sort of a moving target. But the fact remains that Detroit is still going to hell, and people still need to be paying attention to that. The other chapter that I'm going to read a little bit from is about Etan Thomas, who was a player with the Washington Wizards. For us, he really epitomized some of the best in black masculinity and a real counter-interpretation of what black masculinity is and how it can be used as a power for good in progressive politics and activism. So with that, I will read a little bit from this chapter. When the Congressional Black Caucus called, he was there. Ditto for when John Kerry's people tapped him for the campaign. when the NAACP, ACLU, and the Campaign to End the Death Penalty needed a celebrity endorser, they called him. In September of 2005, the United States for Peace and Justice and the Answer Coalition helped to organize a rally to protest the war in Iraq. Would Etan Thomas read one of his poems? This is how the Washington Wizards forward came to be here on this bright fall day, commanding the microphone like a seasoned MC on the mall in Washington, D.C. The NBA dress code police had nothing to say about the 27-year-old's look today, which is more granola than big man. The goatee is scruffy, wireless glasses sensitive, the clay button-down shirt matches the Rasta hat cupping the dreadlocks that snake down his back. Hundreds of thousands of bodies spread before him in the largest national display of anger since the beginning of the war in Iraq. He'd performed for thousands of fans, but his voice had never been heard live by this many people at once. Their homemade signs bear more urgent messages than Thomas is used to seeing while pursuing his first love of basketball at the palatial Verizon Center blocks away. But their collective presence energizes him in a way that the buzzer never could. The ball player gently taps his heart as he thanks the audience for listening. Then he gestures heavenward in honor and praise. I want to take some cats on a field trip, he tells the crowd before launching into a verse he recently published in his first book of poems, More Than Athlete. The words tumble out, slow at first, then in a surge, ebbing and flowing in the cadence of a slam contender, the conviction of a high school debate team champion, and the diction of the son of a school teacher. I want to get one of those big yellow buses with no air conditioning and no seat belts. Round up Bill O'Reilly, Pat Buchanan, Trent Lott, Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, Bush Jr., Bush Sr., John McCain, John Ashcroft, Giuliani, Arnold, Catherine Harris, Ed Gillespie, and that little bow-tie Tucker Carlson, and any other right-wing conservative Republicans I can think of, and take them on a trip to the hood. The crowd roars. Thomas goes on to narrate his fantasy tour through the horrors of America, a jacked-up education system facing even worse solutions, no health care, pro-life zealotry, death penalty hypocrisy, police brutality, and, of course, a war based on a lie. He says corporate mergers, undercover dealings with Enron and Halliburton. The giant hands slash the air behind the dais nonstop, and his knees occasionally dip for emphasis, morphing his finely sculpted frame into a 6-foot-10-inch exclamation point. Take money out of their pockets, call them inferior. The bird of democracy flew the coop in Florida. In just 7 minutes, Thomas will conclude this bus trip with an exhortation of the crowd to vote and a warning to the White House that numbered are their days, his two fingers jabbing toward the Bush residency nearby. Thomas will make several unplanned stops along the way, pausing patiently at each stanza to allow the crowd's hoots and applause to die down. He makes sure that not a single word is lost in the commotion and allows the sheer novelty of the occasion to marinate. Yes, this very tall, chestnut-skinned, very well-paid professional athlete just called out the President of the United States, the media, and the political power structure in the town where he plied his trade. The audience needed each pause for his words to register. It had been so long since an athlete had spoken up like this, they had almost forgotten what such wonders were possible. And so that's, you know, that's, again, an alternate view of the NBA, and that's what we tried to do throughout the book. And, you know, the thing that I'll close with, the most exciting thing happening in media right now is sort of the fragmentation of media and the emergence of new media. We're not as reliant on these mainstream media channels to tell us what our reality is. And so as long as we can sort of get pushed in the direction where a lot of these things are happening, Etan is not, you know, the only person who's a progressive voice. You know, there's a lot more opportunities where for people like this to get their voices heard now. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Deborah Jaramillo, and I teach television studies. One of the things I think is really important for scholars to do is to acknowledge their personal investment in the subject that they're actually researching. So As a person who studies television, it's important for you to know I watch a lot of television, all right? As a Latina, as a person of Mexican descent, it's important for, you know, everyone to understand that I come to television looking at representations in a different way. And as a minority, certainly very interested in representations of minorities. And I think that one place that, well, I think that Latinos and African Americans have very different challenges when it comes to representation on television. But I think, interestingly, one of the ways in which they merge on television currently is at the level of the criminal. We're seeing actually a depth of characterization with the criminal on television where there was no depth before. And I think we need to decide whether or not this is actually a good thing. I jotted down a few things about, or I tried to jot down a few things regarding black masculinity. These things have kind of been on my mind for the past few years. First and foremost, and one of the things I love about television is that it's not a monolith, right? My work is kind of preoccupied with scripted television at the moment, but I think that reality television has actually allowed for many different constructions of black masculinity, and I'm thinking in particular of cooking competition shows and the design show. So we have Project Runway, Top Chef, Chopped, all these shows where you actually, you know, you get to see black men as chefs, black men as designers, whether they're homosexual or straight. These are images that we really haven't gotten a chance to see on television, so I actually think that's kind of interesting. But when we move into scripted television, it's a different and kind of more complicated scenario. And the problem I kept running into was, can we really begin to talk about black masculinity on television at the moment in a meaningful way when it's getting harder and harder to find any black characters on television? So, interestingly, we have to turn to cable television in order to see the greatest number of black characters and the biggest black casts. And not all of this is positive, right? So on TBS, we have Tyler Perry's shows. And Spike Lee has called Tyler Perry's work, quote, coonery and buffoonery. And it is, granted, very low, what's called lowest common denominator programming, right? It's a broad kind of humor, multiple camera sitcoms, not the most intellectual enterprises, but does it need to be the case that it's something else? In other words, when African Americans, really any minority, gains control of content, is there a responsibility there to create something incredibly profound and progressive? I mean, white folks have lowest common denominator programming all over the place, right? And these are the highest rated shows, like Two and a Half Men. Why can't black folks also have lowest common denominator programming? And the issue then becomes one of representation. White folks have a very broad spectrum of representation on television. Black folks, and basically minorities, don't. All right, so this becomes part of a key part of the problem. So continuing on with cable, I mean, we have a show like The Game on BET about football players' wives, right? But we still have kind of black masculinity couched within the figure of the athlete, the professional athlete. So I don't see anything particularly progressive about that. And so then we turn to a channel like HBO, right, which is where nuance tends to live these days. And we have the show The Wire, which many of us are still mourning the passing of. We have black men and boys populating the series as drug dealers, gangbangers, cops, politicians, religious leaders, a spectrum, right? And David Simon, who is white, crafted these characters, created this series, you know, full of characters who were basically screwed and corrupted by the system, by what they called the game, all right? And now The Wire's off the air, we have Treme, which attempts to grapple with, you know, post-Katrina New Orleans in what I would argue is a decidedly modernist way. We have black men and one black woman who are kind of plowing through this latest tragedy that's come their way, while the kind of lead white character has crumbled under the weight of his own privilege. Mm-hmm. So it's actually really interesting to see how racial dynamics play out there. And yet again, this is a David Simon show. David Simon, a white man, has created a universe of black characters with their own unique place-based culture, right? So with The Wire, we had Baltimore. With Treme, we have New Orleans. One interesting thing about kind of television landscape right now with regard to African-American characters, the more you pay for television, the poorer and more disenfranchised the black characters become. All right. So I was looking online to see what fans said about African-American characters on television right now. And a lot of the kind of fan reaction was about how hot all the black guys were, right, on broadcast television. So you have your predominantly white shows with, you know, your token black character in there, and they all have the abs, right, and they're all very, very handsome. But some of the fan reaction was about, well, you know, are we going to see them with black women, these black men, because they tend to be in interracial relationships. But typically what you see on broadcast television are very upwardly mobile characters, right? And then you move to basic cable with the Tyler Perry stuff. You have kind of lower middle class, whatever. And then you get, you're paying out 20 extra bucks to see HBO, and you're seeing the very, very poorest, kind of most disenfranchised characters. But again, is it about realism? Is it about nuance? What exactly do we want from these shows? And sometimes the complications of race in this country are best dealt with on the side, because it becomes almost impossible to narrativize the kinds of ruptures and struggles that we get when we talk about race in this country. So I'm going to get very textual analysis on you guys. Very television scholar here. In one of the whitest shows on television, Mad Men, we have one of the most interesting representations of African Americans on television. Black men and women in this show exist as waiters, as elevator operators. In one particular episode, if you haven't seen Mad Men, it's set in the early 60s. In one particular episode, the lead female character, she's pregnant, and she has an anesthesia-induced dream in which a recently assassinated Medgar Evers appears. All right. Now, the conversation about race and representation in the show exists basically in what I would argue is a parallel narrative. We have our dominant narrative with our main characters, and then on the side, in the margins, in these very interesting ways, we have these black characters who keep popping up, these black personalities. And because it exists on the side in this kind of parallel fashion, it in a very interesting way mirrors segregation, which we're dealing with in the early 1960s. So it isn't that in the show black characters are shoved to the side. They have to live in the margins, basically, and it's up to us as viewers to piece together that narrative. The question is that enough for black audiences? Right. Right. Okay. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For me, as a foreigner who is sort of living in two different spaces, I am at times African-American, and at times I'm Haitian. I'm at times a Haitian who is completely baffled by the black masculinity in this country, and at times I embody the black masculinity in this country. So in a sense, it's almost my embodiment is schizophrenic. Right. But what is extremely interesting for me in relationship to black masculinity, because in Haiti, we didn't have black masculinity, because we're all black. So black masculinity exists in the presence of white masculinity. So in a sense, when we talk in terms of marginalization, there has to be a center. Which is the center? White masculinity. And so we talk about performances. Why are you performing? For whom? For what? What's the agenda? What's the narrative? For me, as a Haitian, the performance might be political or social or class, not really as a so-called black male per se, right? Because we are operating within a black society where the construct then becomes that of class or other issues. But there's a shift that is occurring as we're moving towards a global society. There is now starting to be sort of fringes of black masculinity in Haiti. So now, with the whole hip-hop movement, you're starting to see exactly consumption and performance of a black male, but a black male that is hyphenated. Haitians who are pretending to be American, or Haitians who were kicked out of the U.S. and they are reconstructing their culture within the space of Haiti. When I look at the whole notion of black masculinity, especially in the case of racial dominance, And I remember I'd said to a white male once, about 10 years ago, I said to him, if you were in my country, I would not hire you as my gardener. Because he had called me the N-word. Because my understanding of what a nigger is somebody who's completely ignorant. So therefore, and because notion of color in Haiti, a white person is not only in terms of skin, but is a foreigner. And the constitution in Haiti says all Haitians are black. So therefore, even if you're white, you're Haitian, you're black. So the notion of blackness and black masculinity is completely different. So when we look at in terms of friends also, there's a difference between noir and black. A noir, which means black, but a noir is a person who's French but happens to be black, but the black is an African-American. So in terms of language and construction, it's very different. So within the United States, then, I have to look at why is it that blacks are performing in the way they are. So commodification of blackness through regenerative and negative symbolization, and I will sort of explain some of the concept, he was a bit theoretical. It is when, also, what is the modality of commodification and civilization of blackness? It is when the capital structure that supports the entire society is inherently meshed in the cultural transaction in which an entity, blackness, or black masculinity, becomes a tool of and for the market. Okay? So you are a tool for and of the market. Again, we live in a capitalist society. Everything is for sale. Everything is for sale. And the lowest denominator will be symbolized in the worst way possible. And the lowest denominator becomes that of a black male. Okay. So procurement and vend, so vending, you buy and sell within the market. As a vending or commodifying material, black masculinity must be packaged as a cultural metaphor, a flexible entity, a multi-application package for the household consumption. So we are going to sell you a good. That good is called the black male, the black masculinity. But how I sell it to you, it could be well packaged, as in positive outcome, or I can sell it to you with negative outcome so that you can laugh, because we're dealing with entertainment culture. Hence, as an item, a cultural metaphor of consumption, it must fit the desires or desirability of the targeted consumer in order for it to be attractive, negative, or positive. Its attraction, or farcical, farce as in comedy, its farcical desirability is packaged in its outcome, its symbol. The symbolization of black masculinity or blackness in general becomes the antithesis of the constructive normative culture. So blackness, since it is on the periphery, it is not the normative culture. The normative culture is that of whiteness. So if it is not normal, then it is abnormal. And if it's abnormal, then all behaviors will be abnormal. You're going to be a coon, a buffoon, a jigaboo, whatever, because you cannot have a normal conversation, because from the time of slavery, a black is always suspect. A slave is always telling lies, and so forth. So that is reconstructed and reproduced over time. Okay? So symbolization creates a modality, a medium that traverses or penetrates consciousness with naming, with naming what the symbol symbolizes, So I can show you an orange. You know it is an orange because we've seen it. It's a metaphor. But at the same time, if I start putting other dimensions to the orange, so I'm saying to you that the orange is not good, the orange is vile, the orange is dangerous and everything else, once I show the orange as a symbol, then you already have the symbolization in your mind, in your consciousness, then you know that, oh, orange, bad, not good. So what is commodification and what are the types of regenerative negative symbolization? The symbolization of black masculinity, which is constructed, which we all talked about, becomes an archetype that is now embedded or infused with a prescribed dominant ideology. Every society is prescribed, built upon a specific set of ideology, which is that of an identity. But since we are living in a so-called multiracial, multi-ethnic identity, then we have to ask, what is the norm? What is the norm? Because we cannot have all multiple identities running amok. Because we need to create an American identity. So what is that American identity? Is it Asian American identity, which is the norm? Is it Native American that is the norm? Is it Hispanic identity that is the norm? Or is it Black identity, or is it white identity? It is white identity. It's the norm. And even Asians in this country are becoming sort of the model minority. They're becoming, in a sense, white. Thank you.
Does anyone know who Myron Rolls is? Myron Rolls played in the National Football League for the Tennessee Titans. He was drafted in 2010 as a free safety, and now he's considered active on the roster. However, he graduated in 2008 and was projected to go in the first round of the NFL draft. He was a phenomenal athlete. I don't watch football too much, but for some reason he just stuck out. Instead of entering the draft, Roll postponed his NFL career and accepted the Rhodes Scholarship to study at the University of Oxford. He had completed all necessary pre-medical requirements and earned his bachelor's degree in exercise science in just 2.5 years with a 3.5 GPA. He played the saxophone in the school band, sang in the school play, and was a sports editor for the newspaper. Now, do we know who Myron Rolls is? No. However, back in the 1970s, there was, and there is, a man by the name of Bill Bradley. Mm-hmm. Bill Bradley accepted the Rhodes Scholarship. And then when he came back, he played for the New York Knicks. Mm-hmm. But when he returned, everyone recognized and knew who Bill Bradley was. He was on every single newspaper you could think of. The interesting thing about that is I was actually working in your public library, and I was working in the microfilm section. I had access to all the newspaper periodicals, and when he came, they made sure that they actually taxed me. They gave me the job of finding all the periodicals, the New York Times, the New York Post. You name it, he was on the newspaper, both locally in New York City and regionally, well, nationally. So that's very interesting, the way in which we compare these two, and I'm going to bring some other comparisons. If we were to ask anyone who is familiar with Ron Artest and Kobe Bryant of the LA Lakers, the conversation would stir to Ron Artest being psychologically unstable, running into the stands when someone in the audience threw a cup at him. I mean, how crazy is someone? You throw a cup at someone, he's so crazy to go in the stands. I'm being sarcastic here, okay? And for Kobe Bryant being remembered for being accused of rape. I would have brought up OJ, but I guess you all know where I'm going here. The central issue, I make this comparison simply to point to the disparity in the American public's memory. It is a problem I call the collective optional induced amnesia, where the media outlets, magazines, televisions, social networks, induce and orchestrate amnesia of the American public collectively by controlling images of Black masculinity. They are both understated in the case of Myron Rolls, Cory Booker, Hill Harper, Wes Moore, and sensationalized, filling and numbing our senses with a particular Black aesthetic that shapes Black masculinity. Now, I have two images on the script I prepared to read, so my parents would actually see what I'm talking about, but you can't. So I'll just tell you what these images are. The first image I have actually is called is from Vanity Fair, one of the recent ones, and it has Tiger Woods, bare-chested with two dumbbells in his hand, a skull cap on, and the title is Tiger in the Rough. There's so many connotations onto that, sexual. It just read wrong, and when my colleague over here was talking about masculinity being considered hard and rough and everything like that, here's actually, if you do get an opportunity, put it on, go on Google, get on your iPhone, get on your BlackBerry, and pull up this image, and you will actually see Tiger Woods now in the rough. However, he has dominated the media for a few months because of his indiscretions with his wife. The other image I actually have is an image of the Vogue magazine. And this particular issue was in 2009, I believe. And this image, the front page was LeBron James with the lovely Giselle. Her last name escapes me. And he has a basketball in the left hand and the model in this hand. Now, it may seem innocuous, harmless. However, if you were to take two images, the very original King Kong image of King Kong in this raging, and then the white damsel in this hand, and then you have the other image, which is Here Comes the Hunt, where he has a club in his hand and the same white woman in his hand. And the thing is, within the African American community and in progressive institutions like this one, and in Harvard and you name it, where you have very insightful intellectuals who look at culture and look at images, they were up in rage for this. But the funny thing is that there was not really a whisper on MSNBC, which is considered progressive, the Huffington Post, and a number of quote-unquote liberal media outlets that you would expect someone to tackle issues like this. However, what LeBron James is remembered for is primarily his quote-unquote his big decision. Have you decided where you want to go, LeBron James? Yes, I've decided I'm going to take my talents to Miami. And the entire country went, well, you know how the story goes. They burned his jersey. They call him a traitor. Some of the things that they said of him was in reality very unwarranted, because in reality he was a free agent and he could have done what he wanted. And some people said, well, he staged a show and I think it was out of taste and everything like that. To me, what he did in the Vogue magazine was tasteless. Right. However, he's not remembered for that. And again, this is where you have this collective amnesia taking place. I end with this. In 2008, at the New York Historical Society, they were commemorating, I think, slavery in New York and another collection. And Dr. Henry Louis Gates was one of the keynote speakers. And he brought up a very interesting fact. He said that roughly about 600 or 700 black males are on the roster in the NBA. That's 600, roughly 600, give or take. But there are literally 800 to 900 black male neurosurgeons in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, if I might be a little rusty with math, right? But it tells me that the probability for being a black neurosurgeon is greater than it is to get into the NBA or even the National Football League or even the Major League Baseball or even if you're playing soccer or any other sports in the United States. However, the way how images are packaged in the how black male images packaged, it seems as if anyone can get into the NBA. And you don't need to finish college. You could just do 1 year. Just do 1 year. Take a couple of freshman courses, a little low-level courses, and just jump. Whilst you have other representations of black males that become understated and even erased. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I'm Dexter McCoy. I'm a freshman in the College of Fine Arts, originally from Houston, Texas. So when I think of black masculinity, when this topic was brought up in one of our Emoja meetings, the first thing that I thought about was one afternoon I was sitting in my living room with my family, and we were watching TV like we like to do, and we turned on an Asian music video channel. And what did we see? The Asian guy was rapping, there were girls who were dressed really risque, and then the guy was just pushing the girl around, and you know, and then we turned to MTV, and what did we see? We saw a black man doing the exact same thing. And so what that told me is that black masculinity is something that you have to be portrayed as. You're hard, you're the pimp, you're the gangster, you know. And we not only are seen, we were seen that way, not just in the Black community, but on the greater world stage. And these Asian rappers who were doing this, they saw that that's what was successful in America. That's how the Black man came to be prominent in America. And now they wanted to be that example as well. So the Black man, Black masculinity, you're hard. You don't show emotions. What you also see is selfishness. You know, I get mine, you'll get yours. You know, I'll take care of mine, you take care of yours. I'm in it for me. What are you in it for? But one thing I found interesting, I was doing some reading, and one point I wanted to make is that Black men oftentimes are seen as a threat in today's society. Many of you may know of Public Enemy. They're a group that that does some music.
Cough.
But they have a song that's called Don't Believe the Hype. And in there, there's a verse that says, "The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome of public enemy. Used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype." What did that say to me? Don't believe what I just see on television, what I see in the media, because that's not the example of who I am. That's not what I, as an African, a Black American, embody. I'm in the College of Fine Arts here at Boston University, here on the East Coast, and I'm a Black man. Let me say that again. I'm in the College of Fine Arts here at Boston. You know, that's something rare. Not too many people can say that. I see that as a privilege, but when I look around when I am in the College of Fine Arts, many classes, I'm the only one in there. And when people ask me, you know, what is that like? It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to be an ambassador for what a true Black male is in America. Let me be the embodiment of that. I had a conversation with some people. Particularly, there was a girl I had a conversation with last semester. And she was talking about how she would never date a Black man. And now this is a Black girl. And she said that she would never date a Black man. And I asked her why that was. And she said that Black men are uneducated. Immediately, the sight of Waka Flocka on 106 in Park was brought to mind when they asked him, you know, they said, "Waka, you're a leader. You know, people, you're an example. People look up to you. You know, what do you have to say to people about voting?" And his response as he stumbled and thought about what he wanted to say was, "Oh, well, that voting thing, that's cool, you know, that's aight, you know, that's important. I don't do it, I mean, but you do it for yourself, you know." But this was, I found that to be quite ridiculous because they had a point when they asked him that question. You know, these are the figures that we see on television each and every day. And he is the example that many youth like myself look up to. I don't look up to him, by the way. But many people do. And this idea that the Black man is uneducated is a belief that we need to eradicate. That's a belief that each of us needs to try and overcome. And Black masculinity should no longer be used as a tool for dismissing a Black man's intelligence, but used as a catalyst for inciting change and progress to enhance not only the Black America, but our United States of America. When growing up in Louisiana with my grandmother, I was called many names, ridiculed quite often because I didn't have that Black man swag. You know, I wasn't hard. I wasn't what everyone else thought I should be. So when I spoke, people said, "Oh, you talk like a white boy. You're acting white. Why can't you be Black?" I was called gay because I refused to be that hard individual. I refused to be what people thought that hard Black man should be. But one poem that my grandmother used to say to me and actually had me recite in church, y'all know how that goes. but it's one that has stuck with me. It's one that I live by. And when I think of black masculinity, I think that I pave my own path. I am the embodiment of what my idea of black masculinity is. And the poem says, "Hey, black child, do you know who you are, who you really are? Do you know you can be what you want to be if you try to be what you can be? Hey, black child, do you know you are strong? I mean really strong. Do you know you can do what you want to do if you try to do what you can do? Hey, black child, do you know you can learn? I mean really learn. Do you know you can learn what you want to learn if you try to learn what you can learn? Hey, black child, do you know where you're going? Where you're really going? Do you know you can go where you want to go if you try to go where you can go? Hey, black child, be what you want to be. Do what you want to do. Learn what you want to learn and go where you want to go. And tomorrow, this great nation will be what you want it to be." Thank you.
Thank you so much for those interventions. I'm really moved and sort of fascinated at different perspectives. Well, that ends it, and thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a panel discussion titled "Contemporary Issues of Black Masculinity in the Media." Our discussion was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our panelists were, in order of appearance, University of North Carolina Greensboro Associate Professor C.P. Goss, author Natalie Hopkinson, Boston University Assistant Professor Deborah Jaramilla, Brown University Visiting Lecturer Patrick Sylvain, and Boston University students Dane Peters and Dexter McCoy. The discussion was moderated by African American Studies Program Director Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liambruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.